Dr. Ford, knowing your brother as you do, what kind of a president do you think he'll make?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud of Jerry. I think he'll be very conscientious. I think he'll give 100% all the way.
Mrs. Janet Ford, who's Tom's wife. Mrs. Ford, you've had a very hectic 48 hours. I wonder if you could describe what's happened to the family in the past.
I don't think you have that much time. It's a very hectic day, it's true, but it's one that everyone has to do a job, and we appreciate all the work that the press does and that the news media do, and it's a difficult job for them. And I take my hat off to them because you've done a superb job.
That's Janet Ford, Gerald Ford's sister-in-law, and her husband Tom Ford, speaking tonight in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Neil?
Here in Washington, we've had comment now from House Speaker Carl Albert, who, of course, was among the bipartisan leaders of the Congress who met with the president about an hour before he delivered his speech. Speaker Albert was asked about the reasons behind Mr. Nixon's decision to resign, and he answered much as did Mr. Nixon, who said that he had lost his base of support in Congress. Albert said the pro-impeachment margin in the Congress had just grown too large.
The margin grew by yesterday to astounding proportions, and they grew because the president had not come clean about a certain conversation that took place about 10 months before he said he knew anything about it. But that is a part of history, and the president is going out. What I liked about it was not what he did or the things that caused him to leave his office, but was that he went out not trying to say that he was framed, as some people said he would do. He did not do that. And I think he did a service for the nation in not doing that. I think his speech was more than conciliatory. I think it was a call to the nation.
So there's general praise for the speech from House Speaker Carl Albert. There is, on the other hand, a statement from Democratic Representative Wright Patman of Texas, who says that the nation should learn something from the anguish and pain of the past 2 years, and said, for one thing, that all the facts should be in the public record about Watergate. And, for instance, he called for the release of all those tapes that are being turned over to Judge Sirica so the public can see all the transcripts. I think we're ready now with Leslie Stahl at the home of Vice President Ford. Leslie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Neil, finally. The applause you heard as the Vice President came out of his home here in Alexandria, Virginia, came from a large group of his neighbors who've gathered here very enthusiastically to support him and show them that they are pleased with this obvious transition of power. He was smiling, he looked relaxed, and he gave an his remarks were off the cuff. As you heard, he said that he was going to ask Henry Kissinger to stay on as Secretary of State. His press aide has been briefing reporters here now. He says that the swearing-in ceremony will take place at 12 noon tomorrow in the Rose Garden, that is, if the weather holds up. It has been raining here all day. If not, in the East Room in the White House. Chief Justice Warren Burger will officiate, and he has been called back from a three-week vacation. He was planning to take an Amsterdam. I understand he's either en route tonight or will be flying in tomorrow. There have been stories that the Vice President will address a joint session of Congress tomorrow. His press secretary is telling us that he knows nothing about it. It sounds as though they have not made a final decision on that. The scene here, Neil, is one of excitement from Mr. Ford's neighbors. There were dogs barking while he was speaking. There's an ice cream truck around the corner. The bell was going off while the Vice President was speaking. Generally, his friends are here to support him outside. He has gone back in the house. He came home tonight at about 8:25 and watched the President's speech with his wife and two of his four children, Susan, who's 17, and Steve, who's 18, and his other two children, we are told, are en route home right now. His press aide could not tell us when and how the Vice President will White House, but as of tomorrow at noon, he will take over in the Oval Office anyway for business purposes.
Leslie, yep. In the middle of all that excitement, the least excited person seemed to be the vice president.
Well, I have to be frank with you, Neil, and tell you that I couldn't see him from where I was standing. The crowd, his neighbors, moved in, and I was standing behind three or four people and could not see his face. He sounded relaxed, and as I said, they were off the cuff remarks, but I could not see his face.
One of his strengths, of course, is going to be that he has many friends in the Congress from his long service there on both sides of the aisle. And a little earlier this evening, CBS News interviewed two of his Democratic friends in the House. One of them, Representative Don Riegel of Michigan.
Jerry is a kind person. I don't think it's part of his makeup to be someone who could be vindictive or mean-spirited or cruel. I mean, he's just not that kind of person. And I think not only was he willing to listen to different points of view, but I think he went out of his way to protect, if you will, dissenters within the Republican Party.
And another one of his Democratic friends, Representative Martha Griffiths of Michigan.
He is going to listen to what is happening to the people in the country, and he is going to pay attention to the economic situation in the country. He will understand it. He will be willing to be briefed in case the pound floats or the lira is in trouble.
So it is clear that he starts with goodwill, Gerald Ford does, from both sides of the aisle in the Congress, and will listen. This is Neil Strauser, CBS News, Washington, with a host of our other CBS News correspondents around this capital and around the nation. Leslie Stahl at Vice President Ford's house, Robert Pierpoint at the White House. In New York, Charles Osgood and Reed Collins and many others will be calling in from time to time as we cover this story of the many years that I have been in Washington, certainly. The resignation of President Nixon. He has announced he will resign effective noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow, and that Vice President Gerald Ford will take the oath of office then as the 38th President of the United States. That announcement by Mr. Nixon came just about 58 minutes ago now, shortly after he began his address to the nation, and here were his words.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Mr. Nixon, of course, had explained before that he felt he no longer had a strong enough political base in the Congress to carry on, and that without that base, he felt the constitutional process had been served, and there was no need to carry through with the process of impeachment, the vote by the House, and the trial by the Senate, although Mr. Nixon, up until this week, had been saying that he wanted the constitutional process to go ahead. In New York, Reed Collins, Charles Osgood.
I was going to say that the president points there to a very interesting fact, which is that the agenda for the Congress and also for the president now suddenly becomes totally changed. It looked as if the House was going to be preoccupied pretty much exclusively for the next month or so with debate and consideration of the impeachment articles that had been passed by the House Judiciary Committee. And the Senate was making rules and preparing itself for what promised to be a long ordeal of a trial of the president. Now those things are no longer to be necessary, and both houses of Congress can devote themselves, as President Nixon had once put it, to going on with the business of the country. And Vice President Ford, once he becomes president and has adjusted to his new office, acclimated himself to it, can do likewise. He can devote himself to going ahead with a very, very full agenda of problems worldwide and domestic that call for his attention.
Charles, let's remind ourselves there's another matter which must become the business of the Congress now. Mr. Ford, who did appear to make some informal remarks himself that we've heard within the past hour, and said that Mr. Nixon made one of the greatest personal sacrifices for the country, and who also announced that Secretary of State Henry Kissinger would stay on in the Ford administration. Mr. Ford, under the 25th Amendment, now has the duty of naming a vice president, which will make the unique situation, incidentally, of having men in the presidency and the vice presidency who were not, neither one, elected nationwide. And that selection he makes will have to be approved by a majority of vote in each House of the Congress, as was the case with Ford himself after Spiro Agnew resigned.
Well, I think it was interesting that he put the stopper in quickly as far as foreign affairs are concerned, and made it plain, Neil, that he's going to keep things running pretty much the way they are without tacking or changing course there. And I'm sure that domestically, and particularly with regard to domestic economics, is going to be the area in which both the incoming president and now the resting Congress can turn its wheels to as soon as they both get a little time of adjustment to one another.
It seems clear that his aim will be reassurance in the foreign policy field, and I would say unifying the nation on the domestic side. That is why I think his choice of a vice president will be most interesting. We've had a whole list of names in the speculation, supposedly 14 names drawn up for him by his aides. Topping that list, and much of the speculation, of course, is Governor Nelson Rockefeller, the former governor of New York, who would, however, arouse some opposition in the more conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Neil, one of the men that has been very close to Gerry Ford all of the years that he's been in Congress, and many of the insiders believe is probably going to be offered the job of vice president, although it may be more or less a pro forma offer, is Melvin Laird, the former Secretary of Defense. Mr. Laird, as you know, has been very active behind the scenes in many of these processes of the past year. He came briefly to the White House when it became clear that Watergate was a serious threat to the presidency.
He tried once before in the unifying process.
That's right, exactly.
The resignations of H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman.
And he tried very hard, I think, to save Richard Nixon from the fate that seems to have become inevitable. Finally, he realized he wasn't really accomplishing anything. He was isolated, kept away from Mr. Nixon. So he left that staff job here. But he has still been in close touch with the administration and with the members of Congress. And in fact, in the past week, I understand that he has been active in trying to smooth the path of transition. And with that background, there is some strong feeling that Mr. Ford may offer his close friend Melvin Laird the vice presidency, and there's some question as to whether Laird really wants the job, but my guess is that he should stand high on that list of probables.
Not only in the United States, but all over the world. And in cities around the world, people received the news in various ways. Here in New York City, people gathered in Times Square to hear the president's speech. And WCBS reporter Art Athens was there.
In Times Square, New Yorkers gather, but not in great numbers. They gather around portable radio, quietly and not reveling. They listen to the president of the United States making his resignation. But Times Square is really quiet. How do you feel about it?
It's become evident to me.
I think it stinks. It's all right. I don't think it makes a difference, you know? They're giving you a bone. They're handing you a bone and saying, be satisfied with this when you shouldn't be satisfied with it. You know? It really doesn't make a difference whether Nixon is president or whether Ford is president. It makes no difference whatsoever.
I feel that, I feel sad about it. But one way, it had to be done. And one feeling of mine is, will Gerald Ford be the right man for the office? Since he'll be the first president ever elected, not elected by the people, appointed.
Who are you, sir? How do you feel about the resignation?
Well, I feel it's long overdue. However, I regret the fact that it's left us vulnerable to any enemies that we might have. And I hope that this new administration gets together real fast and gets us on a solid track.
Here in Times Square, most people are are not too happy that the President of the United States is stepping down, even though many feel they wanted him to. Art Athens for CBS News in New York.
Well, that's a little flavor of the Times Square thing, Charles. I don't suppose we would expect people to be out, as they sometimes are wont to do on a New Year's, to watch the presidency come down in some flat iron tower someplace. It isn't really quite that sort of an event.
It's funny, people do seem to gather at events like this, and it's not because they really can expect to see anything. People have been gathering for the past couple of days out in front of the White House, as if almost they expected that there would be some visible sign when this thing took place. Of course, that isn't the way it works, but I think maybe people seek out each other's company and try to get out into crowds on an occasion such as this. It's just some instinct deep within all of us, I believe.
May well be. Let's get some of our first foreign reaction to the formality of the event as we now know it to be. In Tel Aviv, Bruno Wassertal is standing by. Bruno, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Reed.
Is there any official governmental reaction to, say, the fact that Ford is definitely going to keep Secretary Kissinger on as Secretary of State?
There is no official reaction, mainly because it's 5 a.m. in the morning here in Israel, and it's doubtful whether there will be some official reaction till Israel actually wakes up. There's satisfaction in Israel since Vice President Ford already made it plain that he would retain Secretary Kissinger as his chief Department of State man, and the foreign policy that the United States has followed thus far will probably be continued.
Bruno, what about, is there any reaction since it's 5 a.m., as you say, in the morning in Tel Aviv?
Hello.
I can hardly hear you. I think we're having the same problem Washington is getting to Alexandria, Virginia.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm sorry, Reed. Can you repeat that, please?
I was wondering, has there been any reaction at all, or was the thing, as it has been here, well known in advance?
I'm sorry, Reed, we cut out, but I assume your question, whether there has been any reaction at all, or there is a surprise. It came as no surprise to the Israelis, and the last parts of the scenario were pretty well known. It was just a matter of time before Watergate engulfed the president, though the drama of the final moments of President Nixon as President of the United States triggered the drama of the moment and, of course, surpassed any local news, even the tension on the Syrian front.
And that's the situation as we get it from Tel Aviv, Israel. Bob Pierpoint in Washington, how are things shaping up there? Any reaction coming in? Any thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that President Nixon, as he delivered his address from the Oval Office, did not have his family in the room with him. It had been thought originally that they would be there, but instead they watched from the private quarters of the mansion. And in fact, just before the president went on the air, he even asked the Secret Service men who normally guard him to please leave the room. He was told that one should stay, and there was some discussion about it, and we're not yet absolutely positive that anyone else in the room was there except the technicians who happened to be CBS employees who were in the room when he delivered the address. So the president, in effect, was alone with the American people. Now, around the White House here itself, obviously there's a somber mood. Many of his aides and members of his staff were huddled around television sets watching, others carrying radios and listening as they moved. And outside the White House, there was an interesting development in the beginning. Well, I think the thing to do, perhaps, is to have my colleague Connie Chung describe what's been happening outside the White House as she has been in and around this dramatic scene.
There are several hundred young people outside the White House on the Pennsylvania Avenue side. They're standing around Lafayette Park, which is just across the street from the White House, partially because of the television cameras, but also they have come out with firecrackers and sparklers, and they're chanting and shouting their approval of the president's resignation. Many of them are standing in the middle of the street, causing extreme traffic jams on Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House, and there are several people on the very side of the White House peering into the fence, watching and looking, trying to see what is going on inside.
Connie, that is quite a change, because initially, during much of the day today, there's been a very somber atmosphere outside the White House. And not only that, but in fact, there have been a sizable number of the president's supporters out there carrying signs, singing songs like "We Shall Overcome," and trying to convince themselves that the president would stay in office, and trying to convince him not to resign. Now, if I understand you correctly, there's almost a celebration by another group over the fact that he has said he will resign. Is that the way the situation has gone?
That's correct. There's one group, the group that I was speaking of with the sparklers, and the other group is directly in front of the White House, and that group, of course, has been singing nearly all night long in support of the president, earlier asking him not to resign before he gave his speech.
We hope these two groups don't get too close together. We might have a different kind of fireworks out there. Connie, you have also been talking to some of the members of Congress who've been here at the White House. Could you report on that for us?
Yes, several members of Congress, both senators and congressmen, described as close friends of the president, handpicked, met with the president for about a half an hour before he gave his speech. He spoke with them for approximately 25 minutes, I'm told. Congressman Sam Devine, a Republican of Ohio, he's a member of the leadership in the House, he's vice chairman of the Republican Conference, and he's been in Congress for 16 years, said that the president choked up a couple of times as he spoke to the congressmen and senators. He spoke in the cabinet room and said this is the last time he will be in that room, his last speech. Congressman Devine also said that as soon as the president entered the room, everyone stood up and applauded him. And he asked that everyone join him in this tough occasion and that everyone bear with him. Another congressman that I spoke with was Representative G.B. Sonny Montgomery, a Democrat of Mississippi, a man who supported the president, a man who said that the president was not guilty of any impeachable offenses until now. He resigns to the fact that he thought that perhaps the president should have resigned. Congressman Montgomery said that the president talked about ending the Vietnam War. He talked about his trips to Russia and to China and his accomplishments in the Middle East in addition to domestic matters. And he thanked everyone for their friendship and support. And he said that he hoped that he hadn't let them down.
Thank you, Connie Chung. Perhaps you will go back outside and find out what is happening between the two groups outside the White House. Make sure that peace prevails out there and keep us posted while those of us with CBS News around the country at our various listening posts perhaps talk a little about the future now. Neil?
Well, of course, the future is Gerald Ford, who will be taking over at noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow. And Reed Collins, I think you have some thoughts on that.
Well, we have some thoughts about the subject that we have sort of nibbled about the edges of, and this is the task that remains before incoming President Ford to find another like he was and is today. Bob Schieffer has talked with our CBS News legal correspondent Fred Graham about the power of the presidency and about what a President Ford is going to have to do regarding the selection of his vice president.
Fred Graham, let me just ask you first, under the 25th Amendment, what happens next?
Well, right away, President Ford will send the name of his person, his nominee, to be vice president to Congress. And very quickly there will be hearings and a vote, and if that's approved by a majority vote of both houses, then that person becomes vice president of the United States.
And that goes through the same procedures under which the president selected Mr. Ford under which President Nixon selected Mr. Ford to be vice president when there was a vacancy. We just do that all over again.
That's right. Of course, he was the first person to ever become vice president under the 25th Amendment. It's relatively new. 2 or 3 years old, I guess.
In a way, Richard Nixon played a role in, or at least was one of the reasons that the Congress came to feel that a 25th Amendment would be necessary.
Yes, Bob, I was chief counsel of the Senate Constitutional Amendment Subcommittee when that was first came under consideration, and I wrote then private citizen Richard Nixon, asked him to testify in the hearings. He didn't do that, but he referred us to his book, Six Crises, and then sent us written testimony, which went in the record and did contribute to the enactment of the 25th Amendment. It's rather ironic.
And, of course, when President Eisenhower was incapacitated for a time because of illness, Richard Nixon, as vice president, sort of served as an unofficial vice president.
That's right. He served
as an unofficial president, I should say.
Well, he served actually as an unofficial acting president, but there was no procedure then to make it official. Now, under the 25th Amendment, if Ford were to be in any way incapacitated once he gets his new vice president, then he could act as acting president officially.
And who becomes acting president if by some chance something should happen to President Ford before a vice president is elected?
Well, there's a statute that sets out the line of succession, and the next person would be the Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, and then the President pro tem of the Senate. Then it runs right through the cabinet members, starting with the Secretary of State, and right on down in their normal succession of protocol.
Let me ask you this, Fred. Does the Constitution also say that a person can only serve as president 10 years? So does this mean that Mr. Ford, assuming, or if he is elected in his own right in 1976, if he chooses to run, would he be eligible to run again then in 1980?
Well, Bob, another one of the ironies of this situation is that he is the first person to fall under a certain provision of the 22nd Amendment. You'll know that was passed when some of the people who disapproved of President Roosevelt's long tenure in the White House passed the 22nd Amendment, which says that no person can be elected more than twice as president. And he can't be elected, he can't serve but one term and 2 years of a prior term if he happens to become president by resignation or by the death of the president. And that means that he can only be reelected once under the 22nd Amendment. He will have been president only 6.5 years if he gets reelected, where any other person could have served 2 full 4-year terms.
Fred, in your opinion, has all of this, all of what has happened, damaged the presidency?
Well, you know, that was really the bedrock of former President Nixon's defense during the Watergate controversy. He said over and over that the presidency was threatened with erosion, primarily because of the rejection by the courts of executive privilege. But I always thought that actually the facts so disputed that, the legal facts, that one of the reasons why that argument was rejected was that in the courts there were a series of cases challenging overreaching or alleged overreaching by the president, not just President Nixon, but it happened in prior presidents. Impoundment of funds, over and over again, claiming inherent power to take acts, alleged abuse of the pocket veto and such. And it appeared to me that most observers in this community felt that the presidency, if anything, had become too powerful with regard to the courts and the Congress. And we had a condition in the last 2 or 3 years where senators and congressmen were going into the courts and suing the president. That's never really happened that way in this country before. Number of suits in which the plaintiffs were members of Congress suing the president. And I think the reason that those arguments didn't carry the day was that there was just an instinctive feeling in the Capitol that the presidency, if anything, was too strong. And I think now, with no derogation at all to Gerald Ford, people will be happy to see a little more balance with regard to those three branches.
So perhaps in some ways it may really strengthen things. Would you agree with that, in that it does seem to demonstrate that the system works?
Yes, the system, as I said, it was interesting the way the courts and Congress suddenly were allies against the presidency. You know, there'd been a long period in which Congress had been sort of the know-nothing element in this town, or allegedly so. Congress was forever trying to investigate someone on the grounds that they were communists or radicals, and Congress was passing harsh laws to crack down on criminal suspects, and the executive branch would usually take the side of the courts. That swung around in the last couple of years, and because there was, it seemed to be a lack of balance. Now, perhaps the three branches will be more in balance.
Fred Graham, thank you very much.
Our legal correspondent, Fred Graham, in discussion with CBS News correspondent Bob Schieffer, and our thanks to you both. Charlie Osgood, maybe you could catch us up now on what we've been discussing this night.
Well, in the event that anyone wonders why all this discussion, if you've been out of touch for a while, the big news of the night is that President Nixon, in a radio and television speech to the nation from the Oval Office at the White House an hour and 25 minutes ago, announced that he is resigning the presidency effective 12 noon tomorrow, at which time Gerald Ford, now the vice president, will be sworn in as the 38th president of the United States. President Nixon will be leaving Washington before that time. He'll be leaving tomorrow for California. By the time his plane gets to the coast, he will be a private citizen. Now again to Washington and Neil Strasser.